we've talked about for the last couple of weeks. This is being done in support of our Bible Bowl program, which the topic is 2 Samuel. And there's no way in my sermons each week I'm going to cover all the content, but when I was looking at 3 and 4, I couldn't figure out what not to cover, so I'm going to try to cover all of it. It's going to be more of a high-level overview. But before we jump into the text, I want to talk a little bit about something I was honestly thinking about earlier this morning. And that is the difference, one of the differences in studying the Old Testament, much of the Old Testament versus studying much of the New Testament. Okay? And follow with me on this. Okay? So the Old Testament, the biggest percentage of what's in the Old Testament is what I would describe as narrative. It's recording the events that happened, right? Now, there's some exceptions. I mean, those of you that have been reading through the Bible with me, you know, there's not a lot of narrative in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, right? I mean, that's like hardcore laws of God, right? But, I mean, when you go through Genesis and Exodus and you go through, you know, Samuel and Kings and Chronicles and the prophets, I mean, it's covering a lot of time period telling these great stories that occurred from all the way from the creation of man, you know, up until about 400 years before Jesus. So we're talking a couple of thousand years that it covers time period. And then you get to the New Testament and you've got a little bit of narrative. You know, you've got the life of Jesus, you get his birth in two of the Gospels, and the rest of them, you're really just getting a 3-year period. And then in the book of Acts, you get maybe 30 years. Covering in that, and then the rest of it is all letters, right? Which are instruction. And I was thinking about one of the ways that that was highlighted to me over the last few years, and the Reed just visited this place. There's a museum in Washington, D.C. called the Museum of the Bible. Okay, when you think about Washington, D.C., you don't think about a great Bible museum being there, but it is awesome. I mean, yeah, when you go to D.C., go to the Capitol, go to the Smithsonian, go to the National Archives, all of that. Do all that stuff, but go to the Museum of the Bible. It is fabulous. But what they have among, I mean, many, many, many things, but they have a walkthrough, multimedia walkthrough of the Old Testament, and then a very similar thing for the New Testament. And the Old Testament, I don't know, takes like 40 minutes, 30, 40 minutes, and you start... You go from room to room to room to room to room, walking through, and you spend, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes in each room, and each room is a different kind of multimedia presentation of a different story that occurs in Scripture. All the way from the creation in room one, and you move on later, you've got the burning bush where there's literally a bush in the middle of the room that appears to catch on fire. And I mean, it's incredible. And then you get to the New Testament, and it's like a 5-minute movie. Because again, it only covers like 33 years, right? I mean, and then it's all, the rest of it is all just letters. But it's not just, and by the way, that's why most of, you know, like vacation Bible schools are on Old Testament, right? You don't have a lot of, come to our VBS, we're covering Philemon. You know, that's not a typical VBS topic, right? But there's a challenge, though, in the difference in the two in application. Okay, while you could argue there's a larger quantity of stories in the Old Testament that are interesting, sometimes it can be hard when you're studying those individual stories to know what can I pull out of that and apply to me. Does that make sense? Like you're reading about David. Okay, well, in this chapter, you know, these two chapters, I've labeled this aggravations and assassinations because there's a lot of both in both of these chapters. And you can read through that and go, okay, well, that's great, but what am I supposed to take out of that? Now, like those of you that went through the study of Romans, you may go, well, Romans is complicated, but at least I can read it and go, I think I get what I'm supposed to learn from this, right? I mean, what I'm supposed, you know, teaching about salvation, teaching about faith. But what do I draw from these stories about David, and later about Solomon, and on and on and on, and the prophets? And what do I pull from that? Okay. And so this morning, while we're going through this high-level survey of chapters 3 and 4, there's three things. You probably were going, where is he going with this? There's three things from the narrative of this story, which, by the way, this story, I mean, this is like war epic meets soap opera, okay? This story in chapters 3 and 4. But there's three things that I kind of want to pull out of this from the actions of those involved in this narrative that I think we can take and apply. Okay? Now, in addition to those three individual specific things, there's one overarching thing that you can apply to everything in the Old Testament, which is why I have this quote at the top of the title slide. It's been there all 3 weeks that we've done this, that your throne shall be established forever. That this is part, all these narrative stories, whether you're talking about the life of Abraham that we covered on Wednesday, you're talking about now, which is essentially the life of David, all of this is how God brought his plan to fruition, right? How God, starting back with that promise he made to Abraham that through him all nations of the earth would be blessed, well, here's how he's bringing that about. We just sang about Jesus being our king. Jesus is the ultimate fulfillment of David's throne being established forever. And so there's always this idea that what we're reading is not just a cool war epic soap opera story. This is how God brought about his plan to save mankind. Okay, does that make sense? Anybody still with me? We're like, wow, it's only like 5 minutes in. We already got some sleepers here. So everybody with me? Yes, all right, good. So let's jump into 2 Samuel. So like I said, it's going to be a high-level overview. If you got the bulletin, there's 7 blanks. If you're a fill-in-the-blank person, if you like fill-in-the-blanks, I got 7 blanks for you this morning. We're going to hit many of these pretty quickly as we go through 2 Samuel. Before we jump into that, though, we got to talk about a little bit of context because, as I mentioned back in week 1, Samuel was originally one book, one story. Okay, the reason why we have 1 and 2 Samuel is because it would not fit on one single papyrus scroll, so it fit on 2. And so that translates into our modern Bibles having 1 and 2 Samuel. But because of that, there's a significant amount of context that comes from the events that are recorded in what we know of as 1 Samuel. The most relevant thing that we haven't already touched on significantly, I had planned to go into this a little bit last week, but I was already way over time, so I nixed it. But David in 1 Samuel 18, he was originally offered another of Saul's daughters as a wife, but ultimately he was married to Saul's daughter, Michael. Not the first one he was offered, but the second that he, because Michael is recorded in 1 Samuel 18, Michael loved David. But Saul, thinking that this would be a good opportunity to trap and probably kill his adversary, gave the condition for giving Michael in marriage was, you got to bring me the foreskins of 100 Philistines. Okay, thinking, well, David's going to get himself killed by the Philistines. Well, no, David killed the 100 and was given Michael as a wife. But then you fast forward to chapter 25, and Saul, it's recorded that Saul gave Michael to another man. Okay? Saul gave Michael to another man who was Palti, son of Laish, and that is also recorded in 2 Samuel chapter 3. But that, you know, at this point, when we're in 2 Samuel 3, Michael is married to another man. Okay? Previously been David's wife, is now married to another man. Okay. Let's pick up in 2 Samuel chapter 3. The first thing, oh, by the way, got a map. Just a quick revisit. David at this point is king only of the tribe of Judah. Okay? We covered that last week. He's the king of the tribe of Judah, ruling out of Hebron for 7.5 years. Okay? This is effectively a divided kingdom. Now, we're not officially to the time of the divided kingdom, but this is effectively a divided kingdom. And the rest of Israel, which is the part in purple, for 2 years out of the 7.5 years, is ruled by Saul's son Ishbosheth, who has been placed in that position by Abner. As I said last week, Abner's the real power. And that's explicitly stated in this lesson today. Abner's the real power. Abner, who was the general in charge of Saul's armies, by the way, cousin of Saul, is now in charge of Ishbosheth's army. And also, Abner placed Ishbosheth in power. And I believe was really just a puppet king. Abner is the real power. Okay, so at this point, the kingdom is divided. Okay, so the first thing we see in the first blank for you to fill in is the fighting of David. And that is just verse 1. Okay, and I'm not going to take the time this today to read all of 2 chapters. So what I'm asking of you is to complement this lesson is, if you haven't done it in the last few days, I know some of you have because you told me because you're studying for Bible Bowl, but if you haven't, read 2 Samuel 3 and 4. Okay, it won't take that long. 3 is a lot longer than 4 is. But read it, okay? But the first thing we read about is that the armies of Ishbosheth from the house of Saul have been fighting with the armies of David. And while they're fighting, David's kingdom, which is just Judah, David's kingdom is growing stronger, and Ishbosheth's kingdom is growing weaker. Okay? Now, while the whole kind of army in the kingdom is growing weaker, though, Abner is getting stronger and stronger. Okay, that's the takeaways from the fighting section. David's kingdom, his army is growing stronger, Ishbosheth is growing weaker, but Abner, we read in verse 6, is Abner's getting strong. Okay? Abner is the general. Okay? So from there we move on to family of David. And is listed over the next few verses, verses 2 through 5. If I were a teacher preparing you for a test, I might say, you might see this on the quiz, right? Okay? It's listed 6 sons of Saul born to 6 different wives. Okay? I'm not going to go through these, but I have a slide. Okay? Kyle, you might want to learn this for a Bible Bowl. Okay? These are the first 6 sons of David. Some of these we'll see again. We'll see some of these again in much more detail. But born to 6 different wives. Up to this point, the only 2 wives that we have been aware of are Ahinoam and Abigail. But his harem has grown larger between chapters 2 and 3. But 6 sons born to 6 different wives. The next section I have labeled the favoring of David. And what I mean by that is that in this next section of Scripture, which is verses 6 through 21, we have a change in allegiance of Abner. Okay, Abner again, son of Ner, leader of Ishbosheth's army, had previously been the leader of Saul's army, Saul's cousin, and the true power in Israel, okay? But during this section, Abner changes from being allegiant to Saul's family to seeking out an allegiance with David. And so you have a favoring of David. So I want to hit the high points here, okay? So if you go down to verse 6, it says, Abner was making himself strong. So again, this is while Israel in general is growing weaker, Abner is growing stronger. You with me? Okay. And then it says in verse 7, Saul, now Saul's dead, okay, but this is the house of Saul, had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Ai. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, why have you gone into my father's concubine? The implication is that Abner had taken one of the concubines, Rizpah, from the house of Saul. Okay. Now, you got to have a little context here from the culture, okay? From the culture, when Ishbosheth, who was the son of Saul, assumed the throne, he also, again, by the culture, would have inherited the harem, okay? He would have inherited all the wives, all the concubines. So if Abner had taken one of these concubines for himself, that would have been viewed by Ishbosheth like a coup. Like he is trying to take my power. Well, again, there was really no power to take because Abner had the power. Abner had the strength. But this was an affront to Ishbosheth, okay? Not just because of the immorality of it, but because this was an act of aggression. by him taking one of his, essentially one of his concubines. Okay, so he confronts him about it. He confronts him about it, and this is one of the first of the aggravations, because Abner, Ishbosheth may have been angry, but Abner gets really angry. Okay, Abner gets really angry. We read that in verse 8. Abner was very angry. And later on he says, I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul. He says, I've been loyal to Saul. Basically, I've been enduring with you, and I've still been loyal to Saul. Okay? And so he moves from maybe, you know, what could be he's growing in strength, which you could view as self-serving. He's building up his own power while the rest of the country is falling. They're weakening. Abner's growing in power. To now, he's switching now. He's going to be driven by revenge. Because Ishbosheth dared to call him out on this action, Abner becomes very angry, and Abner turns into, all right, now, because I have been loyal to Saul, and now Saul's house has turned on me, I'm going to show you where the real power lies. Okay? And so you move down, you heard the reading this morning that Charlie read to us. He says, am I a dog, a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers, to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David. And yet you charge me today with a fault concerning a woman. God do so to Abner, and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him. So it's common knowledge that David has been anointed king, ultimately, of all Israel. And what Abner is saying now is, because you have not returned the loyalty to me, I'm going to avenge myself by helping David become king of all Israel. Okay? Now, I think there's a point to be taken here. I believe that Abner's motivation first was to grow in power. Because the whole country, it says, and the army is growing weaker, but Abner's growing stronger. Which tells me that Abner was seeking his own power, his own strength. And then you have a shift to now Abner leaves the family that he's associated with to go and join another family so that he can strike down the family of Saul. Which, again, smells to me like revenge. Okay? These are neither one of these qualities are ones that you would associate with someone who was a follower of God, right? Seeking your own power or seeking to avenge yourself. Not qualities of one who would be seeking God, but what does God do with this maybe impure motivations that drive Abner to do these things? What does God do with that? He uses those things that Abner does to bring his will about. You with me? Because this is the key turning point that leads to David expanding his kingdom to all of Israel, as Abner says, from Dan to Beersheba. And actually, the width that was spoken of much earlier. But from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south, saying, you know, now David is going to become king of all Israel. So in these, you know, impure motivations of Abner, God is still working to bring about his will, which is, again, big picture, is to ultimately bring about the Messiah into this world. Okay? So God is using that. It reminds me, and I've got this in your bulletin, Philippians chapter 1, I won't take the time to go and read this, but in Philippians 1, Paul is talking about how his imprisonment has served to grow the gospel. It's a whole other topic for another day. But then he said, there are some who are preaching out of what? Rivalry, envy, right? They're trying to make a name for themselves. But what does he say about those who are preaching out of envy, out of jealousy, out of trying to make a name for themselves? He says, well, I'm just thankful that the gospel is still being preached, right? It's like, you know, they're hurting themselves, but the gospel is still making it out there. God is still using what they're doing to spread the gospel. And the idea here, though, is that God's always working. God's always working. Even if we don't always explicitly see it, God is always working. And a reminder, Romans 8, you know, a passage that's so often taken out of context. You know, for all things work together for good, for those who love the Lord, for those who are called according to His purpose. A lot of folks will say, hey, if you're doing what God wants, things are always going to go well for you. No. Never promise that in Scripture. But what it is a promise is, because earlier he had been talking about the future. You know, there's going to be a time when there's going to be glory, when the glory that you receive is so much greater than what you're going through right now that you can't even compare the two. And I think Paul's saying, hey, if you are striving to serve God, if you are living your life in a right relationship with God, and you are living with Him as your master, then you can be sure that whatever you're going through in this life, God is working for your eternal good, even when you can't see it. And so I love seeing how God even takes the bad decisions of man and ultimately uses those to bring about His will, in this case, establishing David's throne forever. So Abner reaches out to David in the aftermath of this conference. By the way, when Abner leaves, you look in your text, it says Ishbosheth could not say anything back to him because why? He was afraid. He confronted him, but then he was like, uh-oh, the real power just left, right? The real power just left. There's another point in that coming up, because where was Ishbosheth's faith, really? It was in Abner, right? It was in Abner, and Abner leaves, and he's like, uh-oh, okay, we've got a problem, all right? So we move from the favoring to the frustration, okay? And this is ultimately the frustration of David. David is going to become very aggravated, very angry in this next scene that we look at in the latter part of chapter 3. So to hit the highlights here, if we move down to the last part of the chapter, beginning in verse 22, what we see is that Abner reaches out. This happened back just a little bit earlier, before 22. We'll get to that. So before 22, Abner has reached out to David. I want to make a covenant with you. And what does David say? I'll do it, but there's one condition. What's the one condition? You got to bring me Michael back. Okay, you got to bring Michael back, which is why I covered that in the context. Because if you just read this chapter, you're going to go, and don't know about 1 Samuel, you're going to go, who's Michael, right? He says, you got to bring me Michael back, okay? And so then it's mentioned that she's taken away from the husband that Saul had given her to. And Michael is brought back, and so that covenant is completed. And then when you move into 22, Abner comes to Hebron. They have a party for him. Abner comes with 20 men. David throws a feast in Hebron, and then Abner goes out to start working on trying to get those in Israel to turn over to David. So he leaves, and then who comes in? Joab. Now, reminder: who's Joab? Joab is the head of David's army. Okay. And he had had a brother back in chapter 2 that had been killed, okay, by who? Abner. Does that have a play in this story? Absolutely, okay. Azahel was killed by Abner back in chapter 2, okay. When this conflict started, when they started this conflict at the Pool of Gibeon, they had a battle where David's army lost a total of 20 people, including Azahel, and Saul's army, Ishbosheth's army, lost 360. Okay, that's kind of when this conflict began. So remember that. But Joab now comes into camp and finds out not only has Abner been there, but David let him leave. And Joab is like, what are you doing? What are you doing? I mean, look at what he actually says. Go down to verse 24. What have you done? He's saying that to the king. What have you done? And what Joab states outright is, well, he's got to be a spy, right? The only reason he came in was so he could see the details of what you're doing. And then you just let him go? But what is Joab's real concern here? He's angry because Abner killed his brother. Abner killed his brother. And how do we know that? Because it tells us in the next section. Okay, in the very next section, you have Joab, who leaves the presence of David. Go down to verse 28. 26. Wow, my vision's getting bad. You got into verse 26. He came out of David's presence. What did he do? He sent messengers to Abner. Come back. Okay? Come back. All right? It says he sent him out. He sent him out to the cistern of Sirrah. You might want to know that for the test. Young folks, older folks. But sent him out to go bring Abner back. And when Abner comes back, what happens? Joab and the other brother, every time I say the other brother, I think about the Newhart show. My other brother Daryl. But the other brother, okay, Abishai, Joab and Abishai, who again, Abner had killed their brother. So what do? They kill Abner. They kill Abner, okay? Now, how does David feel about that? Not happy, Bob, right? Not happy, okay? He's not thrilled with that. He didn't want that. He didn't want it to happen. And so much so did he not want that to happen that he curses Joab, his father's house, and Joab's descendants. And one of the curses is, may there always be a leper in your family. We talked about the leper this morning. May there always be a leper in your family. I mean, that's, David's pretty upset, right? He's pretty upset. And throughout all of this, we see this continual loyalty to the house of Saul. Because Abner's from the house of Saul. He's a cousin of Saul, the general of the army. He's loyal to the house of Saul. Why? Because Saul was the anointed of God. And he's loyal to him. He's loyal to him. And so, from this, David mourns the death of Abner. He mourns the death of Abner, and Abner is buried. He's buried in Hebron. Okay, so we have another lamentation. Much shorter than the one for Saul. We have a lamentation that's given in verse 33 and 34. And then we end our chapter 3 as we know it by saying, David saying, the Lord repay the evildoer according to his wickedness. Who's he talking about? Joab, okay? His commander, Joab, okay? Now, let's move into chapter 4. Chapter 4. And the first thing we read about in chapter 4, we're going to change from an F to a D to mark the change in the chapter on our labels here, okay? The first thing we read about in chapter 4, if you go to verse 1, it says, when Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died at Hebron, what happens? His courage failed, and all Israel was dismayed. So your word is dismay, because Abner had his faith where? Ishbosheth, his faith was in Abner. And I have to believe from reading that, I mean, the thing that I infer from that is that Ishbosheth, as soon as Abner left, after he confronted him, he's thinking, I hope he comes back. 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 Because that's where all the power was. Because what was happening to the rest of Israel? It was growing weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker. And now, the only one that the people of Israel put their faith in was this man Abner, who is not only is he gone to the house of David, but now he is dead. And their courage failed. Okay? And I think this is the second lesson. By the way, if you missed the first lesson, it was that God's working even when man is doing terrible things. God can still be working behind the scenes. The second thing is that this is a prime example of what faith placed in yourself or faith placed in man will ultimately lead to, right? If you put your faith in something of this earth, whether it's man or money or whatever, what's ultimately going to happen? It's going to let you down, right? It's going to let you down. Now, to this point, David has been pretty consistent in showing his allegiance to God. Now, he's going to have some issues later on, but Ishbosheth is putting his faith in Abner. And now Abner is gone, and he's afraid. And the people of Israel are afraid. And I've got there a reference, just a single passage, Matthew chapter 6, which this is the Sermon on the Mount, passage you're familiar with about where we put our treasure, okay? Which I believe is where you put the priority of your life, is what Jesus is saying. Could that also include money? Sure. But he says, you don't put your treasure where? On the earth. Why? Because moth and rust destroy, thieves break in and steal. What's that a way of saying? That everything in life can happen to what you put your faith in if it's down here, right? If your faith is in money, what can happen to the money? Overnight, it can go away. If your faith is in your health, what can happen? Overnight, it can go away. And ultimately, it is going to go away, right? If your faith is in another person, what's going to happen? They're going to ultimately let you down. If you truly are putting all your weight on another person, right? But if you put your faith where? If you put your faith in God, then all the stuff that happens down here is not going to touch it. It's not going to touch it. It's outside of the reach of the nature of the world that we live in. And so Ish-bosheth found that out. I'm putting my faith in Abner. Now Abner's gone. We're all afraid. We're all afraid. And ultimately that's going to cost Ish-bosheth his life. It's going to cost him his life. Not that he's afraid, but that all the people of Israel are also afraid. Because all the people of Israel are going, we can't just have this guy, right? Abner's gone. We can't just have this guy left. We got to seek our own solution to that problem. Okay? And that solution, by the way, this is the dismay before the assassination. The next point is the details of the assassination. Now, we've already had an assassination. Joab and his brother killed Abner. But now we have another assassination. And this assassination is the assassination of Ish-bosheth. And here, we are introduced to two individuals who are captains in Ish-bosheth's army. If you go down to verse 2, it says, Saul's son had two men who were captains of raiding bands. The name of one was Baanah, and the name of the other was Reshah. So Baanah and Reshah, captains in Ish-bosheth's army, and their brothers. Okay? And their brothers. And what do these two brothers do? Okay? What do these two brothers do? I'm going to hit pause on that for just a second. And we're going to pick up in verse 4. Okay? Because in verse 4, there's this real strange, sudden left turn. Okay? Talking about these two brothers who are captains. Okay? They're captains. And then all of a sudden it mentions Jonathan. Well, who was Jonathan? He was the son of Saul, who is deceased. He died in the same place and the same time as Saul on Mount Gilboa, back in 1 Samuel chapter 31. Why is Jonathan being mentioned here? Because it's mentioned his son, who is one of those of you that don't know, my wife is a sign language interpreter. She interprets at the Bellevue Church of Christ, which is where I was 2.5 weeks ago on a Wednesday night. And you guys know that I will go any which direction whenever the Spirit moves me. I just start talking about who knows what. And it occurred to me all of a sudden, like, this is like the story of, and I said Mephibosheth, and she's signing, and I'm thinking, oh no, I just messed it up. And then I said it again, because that's a really hard word, name, to fingerspell really fast. I said it 3 times in like 2 seconds. And I was like, oh, she's going to be so irritated at me. But anyway, but we're introduced to this kid, son of Jonathan, named Mephibosheth, okay? And all we learn in this, Mephibosheth is going to show up later. I can say it as many times as I want this morning because she's not here, okay? Mephibosheth, we learn later, he's going to be important, really important later. But right now, all we're told is what? After the death of Saul and Jonathan, his nurse is trying to flee with him and she falls, and what happens to Mephibosheth? He becomes lame. Okay? And the question, and then it's back to, and then after that little brief introduction, it's back to Baanah and Reshah. So it's like, why? Why is this little Mephibosheth thing in there? I'm going to tell you my opinion. It's all it is. But I think this is, because what's about to happen? Ish-bosheth's about to die. Okay? The sole heir to the throne of Saul from his family. So who would the next heir be? Well, a son of one of his sons, a grandson, who might be Mephibosheth. And I think the reason why this is in there is to go, here's why Mephibosheth didn't take the throne. Because he's been lame since he was 5 years old. Okay, you with me? I think that's why that's there. By the way, later on, David's going to continue to show loyalty to the house of Saul by taking in Mephibosheth. Okay, I've said that like 30 times, haven't I? So, anyway, now we come back to Reshah and Baanah. Now, the whole country of Israel is afraid because Abner's no longer there. And they're thinking, this guy, Ishbosheth, he's not it, right? I mean, what's going to happen to us if he's the guy? So what do these two captains in his army, what do? They go into his house. They stab him. It's not for without detail. Stab him in the stomach, cut off his head, right? As I said, it's like war epic and soap opera all together, okay? Stab him in the stomach, cut off his head. And then what do they do with the head? They'll get it. They go down to Hebron and go, look what we got, right? And this is very similar to what happened in the first chapter with the messenger who came from Mount Gilboa, right? He comes not with a head, but with a crown and with an armlet, right? A bracelet. He comes with those and he goes, Saul and Jonathan are dead. How do you know? Cut to the chase. I killed him. And what's he thinking? I believe he's thinking, because he didn't actually kill him, he's thinking, this is the mortal enemy of David. David's going to reward me. And what is David rewarding with? Execution. Okay? Well, do we expect anything different this time? Because now it's a son of Saul. And they bring the head of Ishbosheth. And if you look at the text, we move down to the declaration. This is where Nehemiah, Bani and Rechab come down to Hebron. They come down to Hebron and they show David the head. And they say, this is verse 8, I think. My vision's bad this morning. He says, here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy. What are they looking for? They're looking for an attaboy, right? Woo! Thank goodness you vanquished my enemy. And what does David do? David tells the story of what happened to the messenger and told him about the death of Saul, right? He said he was thinking he was bringing me good news. But then he says what? His death, his execution, was his reward, implying that's going to be your reward too. And what happens? These two men are killed because they killed the son of God's anointed. And again, there's so much here. I'll stop with the graphic, but it's the way that they're executed is pretty graphic. But they're executed, okay? They're executed. Ishbosheth, his head, that was graphic, is buried with Abner. These two men are hanged after a couple of other things are done to them. They're hanged, but this, and I'll probably end up saying this about every week, but this is the third takeaway, okay? Saul was David's mortal enemy. Let's never forget that. I mean, even in trying to give David one of his daughters, what's he trying to do? He's trying to kill him, right? I mean, Saul has been trying to kill him ever since David was anointed. And David, time after time after time, one, spares Saul's life when Saul is right there for the taking, makes everybody else spare Saul's life. And then after Saul's death, he remains loyal to Saul's family for the rest of his life. That's not typical human reaction. And we talked about in week one that one of the main themes of the whole book of Samuel is the theme of humility. Where when those who don't show humility toward God, meaning that they don't empty themselves and fill themselves with what God wants. When they don't do that, what happens? God rejects them. God rejects them. It's what happened to Saul. It happened to Saul very quickly. Because Saul all of a sudden decided, I'm going to start doing things my way. And there's a powerful statement. The Spirit left Saul. And then later, God would tell Samuel, I have rejected Saul. So Saul moves to a position of not showing humility toward God, doing what he wants to do. God does what? He rejects him. Brings in this shepherd boy, the least of Jesse's sons. And he brings him in. And David, to this point in his life, defers to God at every corner, right? Even when it means preserving the life of God. and preserving the family of his, what we would describe as his mortal enemy. And so this takeaway is humility, of giving over to the will of God. And while hopefully we're never in a position where, you know, we have to demonstrate our humility in physical life and death like David did, it is a matter of spiritual life and death. Because human nature, I believe our default position is to be filled with self. Self-preservation, self-reliance. And what God is calling on us to do is to empty that. Jesus was described by Paul in Philippians 2 as the way he showed humility was that he emptied himself and took the form of man. What God is asking us to do is to empty ourselves of our will, our desires, our wants, and to fill ourselves with the will of God. Okay? That's what David's doing. Again, in hopefully a much more physically dramatic way than we have to do. But spiritually, it is life or death. I mean, it's completely life or death. It's a choice. It's a choice. And that's where I want to leave it this morning. Because that choice of emptying self and taking on the will of another is the choice that we're all confronted with. And it's not easy because, as I said before, I believe our default position is self-reliance, self-preservation. And so in order to choose a different master, we have to empty self, as David did, as David has done to this point, to choose to fill ourselves with someone else. The decision to do that we call repentance, which is a commitment. It is a turning. It's a turning around. It's a choosing a new master, but it's a commitment to say, God, I'm going to live my life for you instead of me. I'm going to empty myself of my will, and I'm going to give it to you. And then it's a public declaration of that same thing and a participation in baptism. In a baptism, which is the beginning of a new life with a new master, a new covenant. If you've never made that choice, we encourage you to think about that this morning. If there's anything else we can do for you, please come while we sing our invitation song.